Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. We have an all-new episode today, and we are so excited to be kicking it off with two of our friends, Antonio Diaz, Casey Felton, who launched a Kickstarter for their new series, Fire the Menu. We chat about the current landscape of cooking shows, how they met, and what they hope to do and say with their new show. Please, if you can, support their Kickstarter. There is a link to it in the show description. And then we head to London, where Hatice Noy sits down to chat with us before she heads out on tour around the world. If you're in America, it's her debut, and I suggest you check it out. We chat about what she eats before she goes on the road, how her songs balance hope and disaster, and what she loves and is looking forward to when she goes out on a new adventure. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on HRN.
Thank you.
Casey and Antonio, welcome to Snacky Tunes. So good to see both of you. And congratulations on the launch of your Kickstarter.
Darren, it's always so good to see your face.
So good. You guys are 30% funded, and I wanted to get you guys on the show as fast as possible because, you know, there's only, I think by the time this airs, it'll be about 20 days left. And before we dig into that and fire the menu and everything, I wanted to do a little bit of level setting for people who may not be as familiar with maybe the culinary world and mostly culinary food shows and things like that. So Casey, from a chef and talent point of view, and Antonio from a producer, creative point of view, broad strokes, what's the landscape look like?
Antonio, why don't you take this one?
Wow. So this is interesting because Casey, you represent the restaurant industry, and I kind of represent the media side of the restaurant industry. And Darren is kind of like in the middle, right? That's what I always love talking to Darren about, because yeah, we're both kind of like in the same space, and we're seeing it from sidelines, but we're also seeing the demise of our own industry as well. So I think like you have restaurants and then you have food media, and they both need each other, but they're both in sort of like spiraling into this dark abyss of desperate need to change, you know, something needs to change at some point. And the way that people are consuming content is also vastly different than what it was back when like Jonathan Gold was writing. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting time because restaurants need media and attention, and the prices and inflation is affecting the way that restaurants can operate and survive. Meanwhile, media is also having its own sort of crisis in how it's being funded and how it's being consumed. So Casey and I, we kind of came up with this idea of, well, we should change how we support restaurants and create a new method of media that will appeal for us, because we also need to create media and get eyeballs and attract people that are consuming media in a different way. You have people watching YouTube now more than ever. You have people glued to their TikTok, video, Instagram. No one is reading what these like legacy newspapers are writing about. Like, no one's reading restaurant reviews.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah, but you know, with the democratization with TikTok and YouTube, one could argue that the talent and access has never been as diverse, right? Like, compared to 5-10 years ago, the people who can make shows, who can have a voice, who can reach people with food and points of view and restaurants that are covered or things like that, it's never been a better time for that. So,
absolutely.
So, but on the flip side, and I just saw, I won't name them, but a local barbecue spot in LA who said, we're done giving free food to influencers anymore. So is what you're talking about, like trying to find this old world aesthetic, but going forward with like a new type of model, because it seems like there is a new model, but it's the model that maybe people who want a different type of show may not be going to.
The current model that is successful right now is celebrity chefs cooking for like celebrity friends, right?
Sure.
Because that is what's being funded on a major network streamer sort of platform. You got the Netflixes and the Amazons of the world investing on basically safe bets, which are people that already have credibility and have a huge following, you know? And that works. And you have these networks that are just kind of spending in a safe way. And what we're trying to do, and you're right, the landscape is democratized, but we're not really tapping into how people consume. And it's all about algorithms, and it's about human behavior and consumption. The restaurant world and just food media in general has been a little slow in tapping into how this world has changed so quickly. So that's sort of like where we kind of come in and trying to put a different voice, put a different face, which is Casey, really a female voice, independent, and take this model and, like you said, democratize it, give it to the people, give it to fund it through the people, share it through the people with YouTube, you know, and it's a fresh new voice, and it's something that's we're not really seeing.
Sure.
And it, yeah.
Well, it reminds me, you know, we're chatting a couple days after the Oscars and in Cord Jefferson's acceptance speech talking about, let's not do one movie for $200 million. Let's do $10, $20 million. And I think that's sort of what you're getting at here, is that it still takes an investment, but allows Casey, someone like you, who's maybe not a celebrity. I mean, you're a celebrity to us, you know.
That's very kind. I'll take it.
But taking a chance on investing and growing people and things like that, and still having not just, again, TikTok type of aesthetic, but having like a show type of aesthetic. And, you know, Casey, in sort of that mindset of like a lower investment and more, that's not a safe bet. What are you and your colleagues looking forward to when it comes to cooking shows for people who are maybe in the field or looking for that type of, you know, I'm a professional, I put in this time in a restaurant, and now I want to do something in media?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of silver linings to cooking, because there's a lot of hardship and there's quite a few obstacles when going into becoming a cook or becoming a chef or opening a business entirely on your own. But one of the silver linings is the camaraderie. And mm-hmm. I know it sounds mm-hmm. like kind of cheesy, but it honestly is what restaurants probably do best. And I think that being able to showcase, at least locally right now, within the budget we're doing for Fire the Menu, we have for Fire the Menu, is going in and celebrating the voices in the restaurants that we do know and we have access to and we have relationships with. And I do think it's been really interesting, because I've been running a restaurant for 6 years. Before that, I was working abroad and locally here in Los Angeles as either a sous chef or just a line cook or whatever. And you don't have the time. You're not afforded the time to go really support other people.
Mm-hmm,
you know, mm-hmm. you are in such an insular space of just your work. And to now be afforded with Antonio and with Fire the Menu, the time and the space to go in and speak with other chefs, some of whom I came up with. And some of whom I've known of, but have never actually been able to talk to, it is creating a network and a familiarity of voice collectively. And I think that is what's really special about Fire the Menu.
Yeah, it seems that what you're trying to tap into is this community where, I would say, with maybe the exception of David Chang, who is like probably the biggest celebrity chef and knows these people, and they like are his friends. And especially on his new live show, he's bringing friends from that community together. But other celebrities or celebrity run shows, they may just be fans, but are not actually in it, or people on the influencer. And they're just being like, this is the hip new thing. I may not be invested in this restaurant beyond just this video. And so you're not just building a show, you're building a spotlight on how this is all interconnected, which is something you don't really see that much on TV these days. Do you think that people at home want to see that connectivity and get that insider access? Is that what they're looking for, because they feel that it might be missing as well?
I mean, I think at the end of the day that people want to feel like they're having backstage access to mm-hmm. a restaurant, they have insider access to anything. This is no different than how people build relationships with influencers that they don't even know about.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you watch someone on TikTok or Instagram and you watch them over and over and over. You feel like you have like some sort of bond with this person because you're seeing how their lives play out. We're now at a point where, celebrities aren't that interesting anymore. Like, we'd rather watch someone on social media, and then they become who we're, you know, being influenced by. And they right. seem just like regular people, but they have like millions of followers.
And get into any restaurant.
And can get into any restaurant. So what we're trying to do is also put the influence, power, and the expertise back to real chefs build them up. Because these chefs are the ones that are moving the needle forward as far as food mm-hmm. and cuisine and culture. And yet they're too busy running a restaurant than building an Instagram following. They can't have millions of followers like some of these amateur influencers that are cooking on Instagram or TikTok because they're busy running a restaurant.
Right. But the influencers are putting their 60 hours, 80 hours a week into building, and more power to them. More power to them. God bless them. Because some of those reviews do change the trajectory of a restaurant. But I understand being like, I went to culinary school. I ran the business. These are my people. And I'm bringing you with me to the kitchen. Casey's going to hold my hand.
Right.
And these real chefs are unfortunately in a precarious position because they don't have a lot of voice. They're beholden to someone else. They're beholden to what this influencer is going to say about their restaurant or who they're going to bring. It's not even like restaurant critics anymore. It's really these influencers that are on social media that are driving the needle forward for a restaurant. They could make or break a restaurant.
Yeah. Okay. I feel like we know what the landscape is. I want to take a quick musical break because I want to talk about how you two met, how I got the idea for the show, and Casey, what it's like to be in front of the camera while Antonio is behind it. So I'm sure you have a lot to say. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on HRN. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are here with Antonio and Casey of Life and Time, and they've just launched their Kickstarter for their new series, Fire the Menu. And before we get into that in the show, how did you two meet, and did you know you want to work together from the moment you met?
Okay, so we met through a mutual friend at a restaurant networking event kind of thing.
Reverse, go even further
back. That part
back.
Is so moot.
Let's start here. You met in person, okay?
We met in person at a restaurant. Mutual friend invited us to go eat some food around the corner at Bestia. Antonio and I think immediately really hit it off because we had already had a couple cocktails in us when we met at the other restaurant. So we agreed, okay, this person seems interesting enough. So we went and we ordered pasta and ribs. And if you know me, if there is a rib, if there's a bone on the table, it's mine. I call that bone. There's something about peeling cartilage off a bone.
Yeah, no, I'm with
you.
It
gives me such great joy. And the amount of char that is on the fatty bits of that is just like heaven. So lucky for Antonio, there were two bones. And so he got one and I got one. And then
I thought I was the same way with anything on a bone too. But oh boy, she left that thing clean.
He was not raised by Mitsuko. Mitsuko is my mom, and she is like a professional when it comes to fish, meat, anything with a bone. It is clean. Nothing has been wasted.
I mean, my grandma used to crack open the chicken bones and suck the marrow out.
She's my kind of lady.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's how we met. And honestly, that mutual friend had looked at us and said to us, you guys need to have a show. And that was how many years ago, Antonio?
That was, a year and a half? Almost 2 years?
No, it's going to be like 2 years. Maybe two a little years. Bit. And we didn't really think anything of it, to be honest.
I mean, that's a pretty fast time to meet and to go into production together.
Like immediately. Like it was like from that first meeting, I knew we were going to end up working together or being part of each other's lives, because the way that Casey's brain works is very similar to mine. And our birthdays were actually like very in like 2 weeks
here
apart or something like that.
We're both Aries.
Oh yeah, not on this show.
But you know, the universal algorithm brought us together, and over a pair of ribs, and we were not formal at all. I mean, literally, like we're sucking down the bone of this rib, and somehow we just connected, and we kind of spoke the same language. We started traveling together, and this sort of like sibling sort of relationship began. And then we started working together, and we realized that we could do a lot, because we're the kind of people that we come up with an idea, put it down like on a napkin, and then next day we're executing on it and see if it works. And sometimes it doesn't, and most of these ideas fall apart and fail, like most things in life. But then we just move on. Like, okay, we try it, move on to the next thing. And that's sort of like the cadence that we have as entrepreneurs, as, idealist sort of founders, dreamers. Yeah. You know? And that's what kind of like kept us in check as well. And there's this sense of expectation from each other that is, it kind of pushes each other to be like, you know, more than we could,
it's a high expectation for sure.
It is a high expectation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
and
you guys
are not afraid to call each other out when one does not meet the expectation.
Well, I mean, you guys went on the road. I mean, you guys just didn't talk about it. And you went to Mexico City, you went to Puebla, you shot, and you learn so much when you're in the field, not just about what you want to shoot and what you want to say about the other person. What was that trial by fire like? What did you learn? Is that when Fire the Menu started to take place? Like, did you like, you're like, okay, we did this in the road and it just feels like it's something else that we don't want to do, and this is what we want to focus on?
I think that initial trip to Mexico City and then Puebla was kind of an exploration of, traveling together, because I think you can really see a lot in one another, and how you deal in certain situations while traveling can reveal quite a bit about a personality or a character. But when we initially went out there, I think Antonio and I thought we could maybe put a show together about the two of us. about two friends traveling together, experiencing life together, but have it revolve obviously around food and culture. When we returned, I think that's kind of when we shifted. You know, Antonio just mentioned, like, we have all these ideas and we're quick to execute on them. Some of them will take flight immediately. Some of them will be put on the back burner and maybe come to life later. But this was probably one of those initial trials that hasn't necessarily led to something concrete, but has definitely led to knowing that the two of us can work together.
Interesting.
And I mean, Darren, you know, you're friends with us. You've seen a lot of the events and the ideas that we've kind of pushed forward. And I think the thing to think about too is we're executing on many ideas.
Sure.
Not just focusing on one thing. And I think that's also what's important about this industry. You need to kind of diversify a lot when you're in media. Basically, just existing, you need to diversify, because
especially today. Yeah.
Yes, especially today. And I think with Life and Time, there's different levels of what we're trying to achieve. There's the in-person experiences, there's the educational component to what we do online, offline. And then there's different levels to our production too. You know, I have a show called The Myron Kitchen, and that is like a big production that's for a network. And then we've got our small short films that we release every once in a while. That's like 3 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And then there's that show that Casey was just mentioning about the two of us like on the road. That is also like a bigger dream of trying to pitch it to a major streamer. And then there's Fire the Menu, which is kind of like something in between that allows us to explore both of our passions and also build something on a platform like YouTube that we haven't explored yet. And like, have you watched the movie American Fiction?
Yes. Go see my reference from the first part where I said Court Jefferson's name, but go on.
You know, sometimes you talk, Darren, and it goes in one ear and just...
No, that's why I love our relationship. But yes, American Fiction, I've seen it.
Well, the part where the agent is like... You could be many things. Like Johnny Walker has three different. Right. And I fully agree with that, where, you know, Johnny Walker has the red, black, and the blue, and like the red is shit. But, you
careful,
know,
careful. We are open to all types of whiskeys on Snacky Tunes and have been from day one.
Darren, the red is shit. I'm telling you right now, the red is shit.
I'll tell you right now, we could find ourselves in a situation where you're going, red, not that bad. Not that bad. But yes, I understand that. And so, you know, this is an interesting show that you're doing, because having produced and directed a bunch of like in-restaurant shows, there is, you know, working within the schedule of the chefs and providing money for the chefs and appearance fee and buying groceries, it is still like a pretty cost-efficient type of show in many ways. Like, the kitchen's doing the set dressing for you. You have really good talent. You know, Casey is the culinary director for Life and Time. You have all your gear. And so it's a smart way to do it. And then you've also decided to distribute on YouTube. So you're just going for it. Why this approach? Is it just like, because we can just do it as we try and sell the other big thing? Like, you know, what are you trying to tap into here with this production distribution approach?
I mean, I think it's twofold. One, I feel like Casey and I have ADHD. I actually do have ADHD, and we need to just move very quickly and to keep my own personal focus. So the speed and the quickness to do something like this really gets me going. And we're not the type of people that we're just going to sit around and wait for other ideas to brew or to pitch or to, I mean, when you're pitching these ideas, it takes like years like to develop. And you know this, Darren, like to develop, to put in the work, take the meetings, do a sizzle. I ain't doing that. You know,
well, like you could do one. You
well,
could have
I am
one.
Trying to do yeah. it. Yeah. We yeah, could, yeah. we could still do it. Meanwhile, I'm not going to put all my eggs in that basket.
Sure.
You know, And it took about 10 years to get to the point with Life and Time where I own a lot of the resources, because mm-hmm. Life and Time is also a production company. And it became more cost effective and easier to invest in video than it is to invest in written content. Mm-hmm. That's wild. Like, most publications can't say that. And it's true for me. So you're right. Like, I have all this gear here and we could just go and shoot. And then Casey, the fact that she's a professional chef who knows kitchens, knows how to cook, it's very easy for her to like just banter with these chefs and like immediately be implemented.
Shared
into
language.
World.
Yeah. Shared language, shared experience, shared everything.
Exactly. And it's not like, you know, God bless her, but it's not like Selena Gomez sitting down with a chef and teaching you how to make an omelet and you know the difference in expertise. You know, that's not that kind of show. Like, that's why we want to do something different where it's a little bit like Masterclass meets Actors on Actors, but it's chefs.
I love it. So what is the Kickstarter for? $25,000. That used to get you nothing in production. You know, 25 was like cool.
It still doesn't.
It gets you a little bit more these days because you can, like we said, like because you have so much in-house, because YouTube and social media provide distribution, like you're like, I can get a show for that. What's a cover? Why are you doing crowdfunding? Like, why do you want the community to be a part of this? You know, what's the practical and like the more like overarching idea of this funding approach?
I think that it has to do a lot to do with being able to control the project. You know, you asked, why are we doing Fire the Menu right now? The answer for me is because Fire the Menu is neat enough a project that we can execute without having to wait on other people to do their job so that we can do our jobs. This is fully within our toolbox. So, you know, I look at Bonnui. Mm-hmm. Now shuttered, but Bonnui was my baby for so long.
Yeah.
And the reason why I did it, I mean, so many people said, Casey, you've worked in all these formal kitchens, you've traveled to Australia, you're a trained chef. Why are you opening a fast casual restaurant in the middle of Hollywood doing Bonnui style sandwiches? And I said, well, because you guys, it's what I can afford.
Yeah.
I am the investor. I don't have backers. So what can I do? I can do a popular street food that I know was done initially and originally because it was affordable. And on top of that, I can put a twist on it. I can make it a little bit chefy. And I don't need to have a front of house, which is something that I don't have experience with because obviously I've worked in kitchens my entire career. I can have mostly a back of house and I can just put out really solid food in a small space that I can afford. So I was able to get Bonnui going very quickly because it was entirely within my control.
Which I love, because you can spend years trying to put money together and then you got to start agreeing to do this, do that. Okay, yeah, we're going to do breakfast. Okay, we'll do this, run this special on Tuesday. And then it turns out to something that like you don't really get off the ground and it wasn't something that you like the look of at the end anyway.
Right. And it's something so frustrating to feel cuffed to someone else's ability to get something done. So that's, again, another reason why I think Antonio and I work well together is because we say we're going to do something, we do it. There's no dilly-dallying, which is a pet peeve of mine.
Oh, yeah. No dilly-dallying.
Yeah, we don't dilly-dally in the kitchen. But going to Kickstarter was a way in which we knew we both have proven concepts, right? I had Bonnui for 6 years, and had it not been for a 50% increase in rent when my lease ended last June, we would still be kicking at Bonnui, but unfortunately there are things outside of my control and it was the right thing to do to close it. But it was a very successful concept. And I think that a lot of the people on Kickstarter and supporting on Kickstarter recognize that that was a proven concept and so that they can believe in my work ethic. Similar for Antonio. He has, how many Emmys do you have, my friend?
Just pan the camera over to the shelf. I know it's right off camera.
There it is.
These are only three.
Yeah. And the other two are propping up the table right now, right?
They're in the bathroom.
Oh, the other three. I'm so sorry. It's your magazine rack. My bad.
Right. So again, here's somebody who has shown the world that if given full rein, he can execute and he can do it well. So that's why we took it to Kickstarter, is we believe that people can believe in us and that we will create a very good return for their belief in us.
So let me ask you this. When this show is successful, how are you hoping that it shifts the conversation and shows what cooking shows and food shows can be moving forward?
It's putting the mic back to independent real chefs, mm-hmm. and getting like an insider access into how these restaurants function, how the minds of these chefs work. We're not seeing a lot of like these independent chefs on camera anymore. You know, there was sort of like a movement with like Chef's Table, even with Myron Kitchen. And even then, like, it's hard to get these shows greenlit sure. again and get these seasons. And we're just seeing like the same celebrity faces over and over. And it's sort of like this old guard. So my hope is that we could put these like independent chefs that are hustling more than mm-hmm. ever on a pedestal and not just showcase them and showcase what they're doing at their restaurants, but we're also open sourcing knowledge, you know? Mm. We're showing you how to ferment from a chef. We're showing you how to make pasta by hand from from a place like Flour and Water in San Francisco that's been around for like 15 years. This is like a institution. Yeah.
Great dried pasta.
Incredible.
And past Snacky Tunes guests, dig into the archives to listen to their episode.
There you go. I'm always trying to plug you, my friend. or, you know, learning no technology cooking from, you know, Brian Dunsmore at Dunsmore here in L.A.
And like, you can watch the video of that with you popping oysters. That's up on the Kickstarter right now.
Oh, my God. That was a beast.
No, that was a beast. Yeah. But those oysters are worth it.
They are.
I mean, they're massive. So it's really about sharing knowledge, getting inspired by chefs. And like, to me, I feel like part of the entertainment is just seeing Casey banter with these chefs. So you have the knowledge, you have the education, but at the end of the day, we're also trying to create entertainment. And I think that's where these quirky chef personalities come into play. And it's just funny. I mean, it's funny to observe, to see how chefs work, because they're kind of like on the fringes of society, and their brains are, you know, part artist, part, you know, militant. So like, there's so many things that kind of play into what a chef needs to go through. So seeing that play out in front of the camera is hugely fascinating for me. So, I mean, I don't know what it's like for you, Casey, being in the other side of the camera.
Honestly, it's almost as if I have this little brother who just follows me around with his camera and wants to hang out with me and my friends.
Wow.
So it's comfortable. It's really comfortable because honestly, all you're doing is filming me do what I would normally do. Go into a kitchen, be creative, learn from others, and work as a team. And God, I love it. It's such a fun opportunity because I do think, you know, you would ask, what do you hope that this show kind of does? And how does it steer how we see media and food coverage? And what I'm hoping is that we are kind of getting rid of that old guard, like Antonio talked about, in which there's always a competitive nature to cooking, especially mm-hmm, between chefs. Mm-hmm. But there is not a lot of, when you have chef owners or head chefs coming together, there isn't like a network here, especially in Los Angeles, where we all just get together and hang out and recognize each other's success or dishes or palates. We don't do that kind of thing. Right. So right now we are able to strip them of that kind of ego, because now all of a sudden they're in front of the camera, they're going to be on their best behavior, and then they're going to realize very quickly, oh shit, we're just hanging out and doing what I do best and sharing knowledge. That's what it should be about. You know, there were kitchens that I came up in where I wasn't even allowed to have the recipe to prep because it wasn't about sharing knowledge. I would get a torn piece of paper with the recipe, and then after I made it, I was told to rip that piece of paper and put it in the trash. because they didn't want to share their knowledge with this young line cook, which is BS.
Yeah.
Now, well, yeah. It should be more about that.
Yeah. Well, listen, congratulations. If people want to donate, because the clock is a ticking, where can they go for Kickstarter Fire the Menu?
They could go to the Life and Time website. It would be probably the quickest way, unless you want me to read out the entire Kickstarter URL. I'll start with HTTPS. I'm just kidding. So just go to lifeandtime.com. There's a big old green button that says support us on Kickstarter. Click on that. You could watch Casey and I pitch our heart out in our little pitch video. And it really explains what the show is about. We have a couple clips. We've already shot like 4 episodes. We haven't released anything yet. So we've already done the work of shooting what the show is going to look like. We're working out the kinks. And this Kickstarter just helps us get this thing like out the door. It's not going to fund the entirety of the show and what it takes to build something like this, but at the very least, it gets the community involved on a grassroots level. It helps us get the word out of what we're doing and involve people into our process and to really shed light into what we're trying to do. And, you know, we're trying to raise 25K. We're about 44% there, 24 days to go. And it's so beautiful to see, like, you know, some of our friends and people that have, you know, been part of our journey the past decade or so to come in and to toss in a few bucks, whether it's even like $5 or, you know, there's even bigger donors here. So it's just beautiful to see that we're creating something from a grassroots level, from, you know, from a community level. And I think that's what, you know, that's what makes this whole thing beautiful and why we're doing it.
Amazing. And by the time this airs, it'll be 18 days to go. So don't sleep on it. Congratulations to you too. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on HRN. Hattis, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thank you for taking the time before you fly out tomorrow, I believe.
Yes, I actually do.
To start an international world tour. Appreciate you making the time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you're about to set off on this new adventure. It's the night before. Mm-hmm. How do you feel, not just maybe in this moment, but before you start any new adventure?
Yeah, I mean, I've been totally like feeling both nervous and excited at the same time, you know?
Yeah, and you're in London.
Yes.
And, you know, before I leave, because I live in LA, I'm like, all right, let me get one last like Sonora Town burrito, or let me go get some tacos, or let me get some, you know, some dim sum. What are you doing food wise before you leave, just so you have that memory on the road? Because the road can be a little dicey when it comes to food.
Definitely. Yeah, I've been having like very basic food of my life, like rice and miso soup and some fish and stuff. Very, you know, basic Japanese food, basically.
And you're cooking it, right? Because there's no cooking on the road, right?
No. And I love cooking. So like, yeah, I've cooked as much as possible before I leave. Yeah.
So as part of this tour, you're playing in America for the first time. Mm-hmm. What are you looking forward to about playing in America? Is there any food that you are looking forward to trying that maybe you haven't had? Any regional specifics that are on your mind?
I don't really know about those specific local foods, but I'm very, very curious usually. Like wherever I visit, I would go local food. You know, recently I went to Montreal and then I had poutine.
I'm from Montreal and poutine is c'est bon.
I know. It was great. You know, like wherever I go, I do this kind of stuff. So I'm very excited about that.
I mean, poutine is one of a kind. That's, you can't really get it anywhere else. Not with the cheese curds and the gravy and things like that.
That's crazy.
All right. I want to hear a song. And speaking of Montreal, the tracks you're sharing with us today, you performed at the famous Mutech Festival in Montreal. What's the first song you're playing for us, and what's the story behind it?
We are playing Angelus Novus. This song is actually, one of the oldest songs from the album. And when I made this song, I was still living in Tokyo. And then at the time, I struggled with so many things, like life things, you know, like relationship with parents or like working in kind of shitty company just for living, or I don't know, like relationship with partner, like everything around me, like was very tough to me. So collecting all of those feeling of struggle, I made this song. But like every time I sing, I always feel, you know, even though I am singing about my own struggle, I can somehow, I don't know, like connect to something, I don't know, universal, because even though the struggle itself is mine and a very private thing, but still, I think people can connect to this kind of stuff, all of it, somehow. So, I think by singing about those personal emotion, I try to find something universal in it and then trying to find healing to it. So the song itself sounds quite, I don't know, intimate and quite serious or intense, but the way it ends is quite soft and try to have some space for healing to it. So this is about that.
That's beautiful. Here we go. Angelus Novus, live from Mutech on Snaggy Tunes here on HRN.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you. ありがとうございます。
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are here with Hattis Nooit. And your first full-length album, Aura, was released in America this week. How does it feel to revisit this album later, since it's been out in the world? Has your relationships with the songs on it changed, especially since you've gotten to perform them out in the world more than just being recorded?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I recorded this album and then made this album, I felt like I'm not going to be able to make another album after this, mm-hmm, you know, because mm-hmm. I actually took almost 10 years to get here. To first album, first proper album internationally. So like so much emotion, memories was attached to it. So after that, I felt like kind of overwhelmed by creating this thing, just very personally intense to me. But it's been very interesting. After releasing this album, fortunately, I could perform so many places, including Montreal and Mexico, and you know, other than Europe even. After those experiences, I kind of feel like, okay, I think I'm ready to create something new. You know, like performing those songs again. Of course, every time I have different experience, and then every time I get excited to perform them. But somehow, yeah, again, like performing is to me very much related to healing or therapy. So, like, yeah, some sort of burden were released by like performing so far, so that I feel much lighter now, and I feel like making more new songs. And in fact, I think I am also playing something, some new song in this tour as well.
Amazing. It's sort of not just recording them, but by sharing them with others. And you talked about the universality, connecting with people, giving yourself or clearing out space with inside of you to make room for new art.
That's so true, yeah.
So as they evolve from the recording to live, and you create these shared experiences with the listeners, do the songs shift in the performance? Because you are, you know, it's mostly you. It's not like you're really checking in with a band all the time. Like, it can be your vision of how you want to perform and what you want to do, and you're so nimble. Are you taking feedback from listeners and what they get out of it and making them, reinventing them?
Yeah. I love, listening to any feedback after the show. I really enjoy them. But I think in terms of the shift of the song, particularly about Inori we are playing next, this song has been changed so much by performing. I mean, actually, when I made this song and when I recorded this song first time, actually this song have two recorded versions, because it changed so much by performing. So the album version from Aura is the second version of Inori, recorded one. And the first time when I just made this song, I wasn't really sure the concept of this song. I wasn't really sure what I am doing with this song, because to me, the concept of this song, or what I was doing with the song, was too heavy. Inori, this song is all about the people who I met in Fukushima. They struggle with being away from their hometown after the nuclear power disaster, and I made this song just after seeing them. But I couldn't really process what I felt there so soon. So I started making this song, but I somehow feel a bit awkward or shy to this song. Like, and it took me quite a while to get exactly what I want to do with this song, you know? And then by performing over time, first in Europe, and at some point I brought this song back to Japan. And then I think when the first time I performed this song Inori in Japan, I finally realized what I really want to do with this song, which was, first I thought the concept of this song was more like, I don't know, questioning nuclear power, or if we can really control such high technology, or more political song to me, that was,
sure.
This song was. But over time, when I performed this song again with people and getting feedback from the audience, and I brought back to Japan, I just realized I want to more like just sympathize with people who I met in Fukushima, who some people still really want to go back to Fukushima to live again properly.
It's their home.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
As a musician, like before I do anything political, I think I just wanted to be with them and then sympathize with them and try to record what they experienced there, what they're feeling, and what their emotion is like, and what's their memory about their home and about the people who couldn't survive this disaster, and anything, you know, anything related to it, more human things.
Well, let's hear Inori live from UTEC Montreal here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
I'm a sensitive, stuck with that.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're here with Hatice Noit, and we just heard Inori, which is obviously dealing with such a very heavy, you know, very, very globally known disaster, Fukushima, which actually happened about 13 years ago this week. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of that coin, you were also talking about like the beauty and the people and and how it all works together. Mm-hmm. How do you balance those emotions of the destruction and the beauty of the world sometimes into one song?
Mm-hmm. I think not just only about Fukushima, but so many things in the world. It's very easy for us to fixate on very negative side or something dramatic or something very, I don't know, negatively emotional things. Of course, I am also traumatized by the earthquake that causing this disaster. But when I make music, one thing I don't really want to do with my music is making music just from some negative emotion. I want to see hope with that, at least, not just pure anger or pure anxious or like anything, anything negative, because I just even personally need some hope even to think about anything negative. And when I make music, I try to find what we can share, even though we are from completely different place and with different culture, history, and even when we have completely opposite thought or whatever. I want to make music letting us kind of find something mutual between us. I think it's sometime like memories. It will be a key in this time, Fukushima. Of course, their experience and their emotion is very much theirs, very private and unique things. But their feeling itself is very simply just missing their home or missing their friend who they lost by the disaster. Or this kind of emotion, I believe anyone can relate to. I think to me it's the key when I sing about something very sad or dark or negative, heavy things. I still try to find how we can share the heaviness and that can heal the pain.
That's so beautiful. I want to make sure that we have enough time to have one more song. Why don't you tell us about this last song? And then also if people want to listen to the album or to come see you on this tour, which by the time this airs, kicks off tomorrow, which is so exciting. Tell us where they can go find you and about this last song.
It's called Silly Talk. This song is about my hometown, actually, my own hometown, which is Hokkaido, Shiretoko in Japan. Shiretoko is such a beautiful natural place surrounded by beautiful forest and lots of different wild animals, including big bear or deer, and yeah, lots of beautiful animals. And since I left Japan to move to Europe, when I am so away from my home, like I, especially at the beginning, like I felt I'm completely lost, you know. Mm-hmm. I had to build up my identity from the scratch again. I felt like it, you know, because I was like a baby. I couldn't, you know, barely speak English, or I was like, who was I? You know, who was I like?
Yeah.
what
who
was
am I?
I?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. Totally. That fundamental question. And for this kind of experience, I've actually had a couple of times in my life, you know, when I moved to Tokyo from my hometown, or, you know, always I, yeah, feel like, oh my God.
Who am I?
Yeah,
what am I doing? What have I just done?
Yeah, I know, I know. So this song is to me to remember that, because in this song, I kind of mimic the sound that I was listening when I was a kid in Hokkaido, like sound of birds or sound of animals, or the not just sound but also the energy I might have been feeling. You know, that's imagination, but you know, me surrounded by nature, like I. Like every year I see drifted ice from Russia, beautiful, like,
wow.
Snowy landscape, and that kind of wildness and beauty of the energy. Yeah. So, this song is all about that, to remember myself.
It's beautiful to have that type of anchor. And quickly, if people want to listen to the album or get a copy or see where you're going on tour, where can they go?
Sorry?
Where can they go to, like, online or social media to see what you're up to?
You can look up my name, Hattis Noit, and you'll find the schedule on my website or Instagram, Twitter.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you to Gio and everyone for setting this up. Mm-hmm. Thank you also to Antonio and Casey. Here we go. Thank you. One more live track from Hattis Noit from UTech, live on Snacky Tunes on HRN. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.